From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jared Diamond's best-selling books, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Collapse, gave us startling new ways of understanding why different societies ended up on very different paths. Now, he's reaching out to the young in particular, to the generation that will make its life in the century of climate change. What we are as a species and what we're facing now is his subject. This hour on Point, Jared Diamond speaks to the young. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Young listeners, how do you see the environmental challenge you're being handed? Parents, what do you say to your children about the world we're leaving them? What's your question for Jared Diamond? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Jared Diamond joins me now in the studio, scientist, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the 1997 huge bestseller, Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. He's also author of Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, and The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. He's professor of geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, an adaptation of his 1991 book, The Third Chimpanzee, by Rebecca Stefoff, is just out, titled The Third Chimpanzee for Young People. Jared Diamond, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us again.
I'm glad to be with you back in my hometown where I grew up.
back in Boston. You have written about so many societies, cultures, civilizations over the years, the challenges they faced, how some met them and some did not. Now we have, in some sense, a global challenge. It will hit different places, I suppose, in different ways, in different degrees. How do you assess what this generation of young people is facing in terms of environmental challenge up against, I don't know, what others have over the, really, you've looked at eons?
A simple answer, Tom, is that the current generation is the first generation that faces the risk of the whole world being messed up. There are societies in the past that messed themselves up and even collapsed. The Maya in the Yucatan, the Easter Islanders, the Vikings, but they messed up their own area and the Maya collapse did not affect North America and certainly didn't affect Europe. This is now the first generation that, if things go badly, will end up in a totally messed up whole world.
So let's go to the subject of the third chimpanzee, not for young people out now, which is in a way the evolution of humans. We're so much like chimpanzees genetically, and yet we evolved quite differently to go right down to the foundations. If you're talking with young people about our species and the challenge we're facing now, what do they need to know to understand themselves, ourselves as a species, up against this planetary challenge?
The things that young people ask me, the things that my own kids asked me when I was growing up, include, so why are we talking to each other and putting chimpanzees in zoos instead of chimpanzees putting us in zoos when chimpanzees share 98% of our genes? What's the 2% difference between us and chimpanzees that explains why we talk? Are we the first animals to make war? Are we the first animals to have religion? Do chimpanzees have religion? How did we develop language? Did Neanderthals have language? Why do we have art? Those are the big questions that I ask myself in writing The Third Chimpanzee and that young people want to understand.
So here we are just this week on Monday. We had the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change coming out with their latest big warning saying, look, this is getting worse. We're not keeping up with the challenge. Climate change is bringing rising sea levels and stressed water supplies and heat waves and heavy rains. It's going to bring food shortages, this UN panel is saying. For the generation that's going to live in this century, what do they need to understand about the evolution of the species that we are up against this challenge? What are we well-suited to confront here? What are we ill-suited to perceive or confront?
A short answer would be they need to understand that their world is up for grabs and that their parents have been handing them a mess, but that the problems are soluble because the problems we are facing are ones caused by humans. The big risk to the world is not an asteroid crashing into us that we can't do anything about. The big risk to the world is things that we are doing, cutting down forests, overfishing the oceans, heating up the atmosphere. The problems can be solved if we have the political will. And young people who can't yet vote can nevertheless start working on their parents, saying, Mommy and Daddy, you ought to be ashamed of yourselves. Start thinking of the mess that you are putting us into.
What are our evolutionary strengths or weaknesses, strengths or blind spots that equip us, you know, well or poorly to address these challenges?
Our big evolutionary strength is our big brains that lets us reason about cause and effect and lets us write down knowledge and talk about knowledge. A big evolutionary drawback is our big brains that allows us to figure out complicated ways of destroying the world, such as chopping down trees not one by one with a stone axe, but first with a steel axe and then with a bulldozer and then with clear cutting. So our big brains are the source of our strength and the source of our troubles.
Understanding the global implications of climate change requires a lot of thinking. Are we doing that? If not, you know, why not?
We are doing. Some of us are doing a lot of thinking. Not enough of us are, but a hopeful sign so that we don't get into a gloom and doom mode is that a few years ago, this minority of Americans, maybe 20-30% of Americans, took global climate change seriously, and now 70 or 80% do. A few years ago, if you would ask me, will Americans recognize the importance of global climate issues in the near future, I would have said, things aren't looking in that direction. So a hopeful sign is that people are starting to recognize the importance of this, partly because of what's happening right now. I flew in yesterday from California, and this is the driest year since we started keeping climate records in Los Angeles over 150 years ago. That gets people's attention, particularly when 70% of the farmers of California are not going to have enough water to grow crops in the breadbasket of the U.S., California.
You've written about societal civilizational collapse. In what portion of those collapses is the environment the basic reason for collapse?
Lots of environmental collapses involved environmental factors. For example, the Anasazi Native Americans in the U.S. Southwest deforested and had problems in land management, and they lived in an area where the rainfall dropped. Environmental causes of the collapse. That's not to say that all collapses have environmental reasons. Carthage collapsed. It had every building destroyed and salt thrown on its ruins, not because Carthage overfished, but because Carthage made the mistake of getting into a fight with the Roman Empire, which was stronger than Carthage. So let's not overstate, but today big problems include environmental problems. And if we don't solve them, we're in deep trouble. But if we do solve them, we can go on happily for a few centuries.
When environmental issues are central to a civilizational challenge, what does the historical record show about how cultures respond successfully or unsuccessfully? You've written about the Mayans and written that their elites insulated themselves from, I believe you've written, the environmental problems that were all around them and so didn't address them.
Welcome to the frustration that people talking with me often feel with me because they're not going to get simple answers. Mm-hmm. My answer to your question would be that some societies in the past messed up and some societies solved their environmental problems. In New Guinea, the island of New Guinea, north of Australia, where I do my field work, New Guineans recognized about 1,200 years ago that they were chopping down their forests on which they depended, and they figured out ways of transplanting trees from the riversides into their villages and gardens. So New Guineans are still going strong as farmers 46,000 years after arriving in New Guinea and 8,000 years after beginning farming. So a short answer is that some societies recognized and solved their environmental problems. Some societies refused to recognize them or didn't see them. And important is to see your environmental problems and when you see them, to admit them and to place priority on solving them and not ignore them.
So what's the difference? What distinguishes societies that succeeded in recognizing their problems and addressing them from those who saw environmental issues but or did not even see them and did not address them?
On the one hand, some environmental issues are really difficult to detect in the early stages. 30 years ago, when there were indications that world temperatures were rising, the evidence wasn't compelling and most scientists didn't yet accept it. So some environmental problems are difficult to detect in the early stages. Once environmental problems become visible, a recipe for disaster is if the politicians and the elite and the decision makers can screen themselves from the consequences of their actions. For example, in Los Angeles, I don't know how it is now in Boston, but in LA we've got lots of what we call these gated communities where rich people live in their own communities behind gates, and in their gated communities they send their kids to private schools and they've got their private security forces. And the gates are there to keep out rioters if there ever were rioters. That's a recipe for trouble because it means that the decision makers think that they can protect themselves from the consequences of their actions, which they can do for only so long. And in my 48 years in Los Angeles, twice there have been major riots. And it's only a matter of time, if things keep up, before the rioters get into Beverly Hills.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse author Jared Diamond about the world, the environment our young will inherit, and his advice to them on how to save it, how to survive in it. One of his first big popular books of science was The Third Chimpanzee. He's now out with an adaptation of that. It's called The Third Chimpanzee for Young People. For them to understand the species that they're part of, and with that perhaps understand the circumstances that we're in. Jared Diamond joins me in the studio. Young listeners, you are welcome to join us as well. How do you see what's coming, the challenge in front of you? What's your question for Jared Diamond? Young people thinking about all this, of course. Here's a little bit of, this is Zoe Foster. She's an ambassador for Plant for the Planet. It's a children's initiative that raises awareness about climate change through planting trees. She spoke at a public hearing in Seattle, Washington, not so long ago, asking adults to support the initiative.
We've realized that we can't keep debating about what's most efficient and best supports the economy. We don't have time to wait for Congress to agree on something for once. We found the solution, and we've already started making it happen. We just need the adults to get their acts together and realize that each year they wait is 30 more years of floods, fires, droughts, famines, and extinctions. Problems you created, problems you're letting us suffer from.
Big UN panel out this week saying, yes, those problems are coming. We are not prepared. They will very likely dominate much of life in this century, the century that young people now are going to live in. Jared Diamond, lots of callers for you. Let's begin to go to them, if we may. Bill in Mount Pulaski, Illinois. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for having me. Mr. Diamond, what a pleasure to talk with you. I've read some of your books, and I saw your presentations on Gun, Germs, and Steel and on Collapse on YouTube, and very exciting. My question is that when you describe these civilizational collapses, you know, the Greenland Norse, the Maya, the Easter Islanders, they were separated geographically by thousands and thousands of miles. We now live in a global economy. Everything is interconnected. We have 4,000-mile supply chains. Our population is supported by fossil fuels and is in deeply an overshoot. So when these environmental factors begin to bite, if they are not solved, what are the implications? I mean, it's not like Rome goes down and the folks in Cahokia are just fine. We're all in this boat together, aren't we?
Bill, you've identified a key issue. That's wonderful. You're right that when the Maya and the Easter Islanders and the Greenlanders collapsed in the past, nobody else was affected. Nobody in the world knew about it when the Easter Islanders collapsed. Nobody in the world knew that the Greenland Norse had died out until a couple of hundred years later. The big difference today, as you say, is that we're in this globalized world where anything that happens anywhere can affect the rest of the world. That lesson was rubbed into the faces of us Americans on September 11, 2001, when things going on in a really remote part of the world, Afghanistan, that we thought had no consequences for us. Now in this globalized world, does have consequences for us. So summarizing your point. The risk that we face today is that we no longer face the luxury of societies collapsing one by one. When some remote place like Somalia or Rwanda or Iraq or Grenada gets into trouble, it affects the rest of the world. And so the worst case scenario for the world now is a global collapse.
How is that likely to affect our acknowledgement of the challenge and our response to the challenge? When, as Bill says, Rome falls, Cahokia off on the Mississippi is fine. When we're all in it together, how is that likely to change our how we take it on board and how we respond?
How is that going to affect our taking it on board? On the one hand, when we are told that we face this enormous problem like a collapse of the world, it paralyzes us. People living under a big dam tend not to think of the dam because the prospect of the dam collapsing is so terrible. On the other hand, there are increasing numbers of young people who are concerned about the state of the world, and they're starting to ask their parents, so here's a teenager, mommy and daddy, what did you do in your business today? And mommy or daddy says some dismissive thing. Are you learning this environmental nonsense in schools? Are you getting to be a greenie? At which point the teenager says, mommy, I loathe you. You are despicable. And I'm not going to talk to you until you get educated and shape up. That really gets the attention of adults when their own children recognize problems.
Given the way our species perceives life in the world around it, does the global nature of this challenge, the scale of it, make it more or less likely that we'll rise to it?
The global nature of the problems makes it more difficult to cope with the problems. Problems in California. So the state of California can discuss water allocation for the San Joaquin Valley. There are problems for the whole United States, which the federal government can deal with. But we don't have a strong framework for dealing with world problems. For example, carbon dioxide emissions. The United Nations is not in a position to enforce CO2 emissions in the way that the state of California can enforce water use. So the problems, world problems, are more difficult because the UN and other world agencies are weak compared to the state of California and the federal government.
Perhaps also because the power or the elites, we read about coastal dwellers in Bangladesh suffering already from sea rise. They're a long way from the rich and the poor of Los Angeles. The more powerful nations may not be the first to suffer most acutely.
That to some extent is the case, that there's a lot of low-lying land in Bangladesh, a country with a population over 100 million, and there are a lot of Bangladeshis who are going to find themselves flooded if the United States and China, the main producers of carbon dioxide, keep putting out greenhouse gases. On the other hand, it's not only the people of Bangladesh.
Yeah,
there's a lot of low-lying land in Miami. I just came back a month ago from Miami. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Miami, there was a flood on the streets, and I couldn't walk down the streets of Miami. So there's a lot of flat land on the eastern seaboard of the United States that's going to get into trouble at the same time as Bangladesh gets into trouble.
Bob in Austin, Texas. Thanks for calling, Bob. You're on with Jared Diamond.
Hi, Tom. Professor Diamond, what a privilege it is to speak with a couple of my heroes today.
What's on your mind, Bob?
I am a big fan. I've read both Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse, and it's ironic that you guys are talking about the impact on young people. About 6 months ago, my son, Carson, had a question. I can't even remember what it was, but it seemed like the answer was in Guns, Germs, and Steel. I went right to my library, handed him a copy of it. He's a prolific reader anyhow, and he's read it. And you can't imagine the look on adults' faces when they see this 12-year-old kid talking about Professor Diamond's work and Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Right. East-West Axis and all the rest, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They look at him like he dropped in from outer space, and he completely understands, as well as a 12-year-old can, the implications of the things that you're talking about. But thank you so much, and I'm sure when he gets home from school, we'll be headed over to Barnes & Noble to get your new work.
Bob, do you think that climate change is on your 12-year-old son's mind, or not? in this age?
Absolutely. You know, we live in Austin, Texas, and we in fact live on Lake Travis, which is down 43 feet. You can walk across this lake, and the kinds of summers that we've had here and the drought that we're experiencing in Austin is unbelievable.
Does it frighten your son? Is it just a reality to deal with? Do you have a sense of his emotional response to what he's seeing and hearing?
Well, as much as he can comprehend the things that he might be able to do to impact any of things, I think he's certainly learned some of that from Guns, Germs, and Steel, and he's in fact working on Collapse now. So hopefully in the course of that, you know, he'll bring some ideas about how to reconcile.
Boy, that's a lot. That is a big education, and at the same time, a lot to take on board. Bob in Austin, Texas, thank you very much for your call. Here you're writing, Jared Diamond, The Third Chimpanzee for Young People. Do you imagine them as readers of your other books? And it goes to the issue of how young humans, let alone adults, take on a challenge/threat as big as the one we're facing now, psychologically, intellectually. How do young people absorb something like this? They grow up. I remember growing up, and yes, we had pollution, but that was considered isolated. It was here or there. It was, you know, you could name the places where it would seem particularly bad. Now you're talking about a global challenge, and I wonder about the young human mind and how it begins to take that on.
Tom, that was one of the surprises for me when I became a writer for the broad public with publication of The Third Chimpanzee in 1992. My books, they're long books and they're about fascinating questions, but they're complicated. And I naively thought that my books would be read by adults. And soon I began to discover that my books were getting assigned in high schools and in middle schools. And the wake-up for me was one day when my twin sons, Josh and Max, came home in the seventh grade and they said, "Daddy, we're angry at you. What's the matter? Your book has been assigned in our class and we haven't read it, but we know it's a bad book and our teacher has called us in to interview, called you in to be interviewed, and we're going to be so embarrassed in front of our classmates." So I came in. My kids were red facing aside and curled up. And as they gradually saw, though, that their classmates in the seventh grade were really engaged in this material and asking these big questions, they started to relax, and they're now among my strong supporters.
good for your kids, good for that room. I'm still kind of trying to figure out how the young absorb a challenge of this scale. It's a lot to walk into, you know. It was easier when you were told there's a big, amazing world out there waiting for you to thrive in. But if you're 12, 13 years old, and what you're learning is there's a big, scary world out there that if they're listening right now, they're hearing you use the word collapse, even global collapse. How does a young person take that on board?
Tom, that's not a new problem. The worries are different. But since I was born in 1937, as a young person, I grew up in World War II, and we were worried about the concentration camps.
Yeah.
We were worried about the atomic bombs. We were worried about the Cold War. We were worried about the Vietnam War. We were worried about the soaring interest rates eventually. Mm-hmm. So now we're worried about different things, namely environmental issues. They're worldwide concerns. But it's not only that young people are worried. Young people are fascinated by the same things that fascinate me and that led me to write my books. Young people are fascinated by wondering, so what's the difference between humans and animals? Why can we speak and they don't speak? Is human speech related to bird song, but chimpanzees don't have songs? What about human art? Where did human art come from? So young people find these big questions as fascinating as older people do. And it's, for me, one of the rewarding things about talking to public groups is that every time I talk to a public group, there's always one or two school classes there who've read my books and they're interested and they're among the most engaged listeners.
Bob is calling from Ontonagon, Michigan. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks very much for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind, Bob?
We just had 74 days below zero here.
It's been a cold winter, yes.
This global warming thing is a hoax to extract taxes from the public. The whole hypothesis is based on flawed computer models. The real data shows we are in a cooling period.
Bob, let us pick it up with Jared Diamond. You've got a lot of people listening right now, including the young, and Bob says it's been a cold winter. This is a hoax.
Bob, that's a valid observation, and it raises an important point. The term global warming is a misnomer. What we should be talking about is global climate change. Within global climate change, the average trend is warming, but there are places that are getting colder, and there are places that get colder and also hotter. Your experience has been 74 days below zero in Michigan. There have also been some very cold times recently in the U.S. Northeast. The main trends in global climate change are the average warming trend, which causes people to talk about global warming, but perhaps even more important is that climate is getting more variable. While on the average it's getting warmer, the peaks are getting hotter, and the lows are getting colder, and that's why, Bob, you've experienced these 74 days below zero, despite the fact that on the average the world is heating up.
But the subtext you can hear in Bob, and looks like we've lost him here, but Bob sounds like a kind of rejection. Call it global warming or call it climate change. He's characterizing this as a hoax, whatever you want to call it, to extract taxes from taxpayers. There's been a lot of this over the years. Many people with this perspective, you can still easily find it articulated. Here's a challenge. Bob sees it as a hoax. You describe it as a reality. What's going on with human nature here that leads people to perceive circumstances so differently and in ways that may have a big impact on how we do or do not respond?
Bob's reaction is not at all surprising, and it's not to be scorned. The reality is that as scientific information accumulates, we learn new things, and we're not immediately convinced of the new things. The evidence for the new things at first is inadequate. So the evidence for a global warming change, when it first began to be brought out 30 years ago, was weak. 10 years ago, there were a substantial number of scientists who doubted it. And now virtually every knowledgeable scientist agrees that there is a warming trend. As for the general public, because the arguments are complicated, increasingly now the general public also is accepting an average warming trend and these climate fluctuations. But For people like Bob, whose concerns are legitimate, what we need to do is to talk about and understand these complicated issues and start talking about them with young people in schools. Because, Bob, it's your children who are going to feel the cons. Bob, your perceptions are correct, but you're wrong. And it's your children, if you have children, who are going to feel the consequences of your error.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse author Jared Diamond about the world, the environment our young will inherit, and his advice to them on how to save it, how to survive in it. The Third Chimpanzee for Young People is just out. It's an adaptation of his 1991 first big book of popular science, The Third Chimpanzee, talking about how humans as a species have evolved away from their very close cousins in the natural world. What makes us distinct. A little sound here from a rally in Portland, Oregon, against coal exports. Children took the podium. A video here from the website Climate Change for Families.
All my life, I have grown up believing in a safe, healthy world. And now I realize that with every passing minute and every ounce of coal and carbon released by human hands, that life is slipping away.
Climate change and carbon don't stop at national boundaries. By exporting coal, we are becoming accessories to a crime.
Give it a musical backdrop, and it really cranks up the emotion. But it is emotional. These are big challenges, and we've got a generation that's going to be living right into them. Molly in Glenmont, Ohio, is calling. Molly, thanks for calling. You're on with Jared Diamond.
Hi, Tom. I am just so pleased to be able to speak with one of my favorite authors. And I've read three of your books, and I'm really looking forward to reading The Third Chimpanzee. Didn't realize that was another one that was out. I homeschool four children, and what I say to them is that it's really important for us to spend time as a family out in nature to really develop that sense of the nature is sacred. It's an important part of our life, and to spend time in the garden with them, producing food for ourselves. And I always, whenever I hear anything on the radio about the environment, especially something really big like global warming, I always want to say, hey, wait a second, this is really a local issue too, because we can all do something about it by reducing our own emissions and doing gardening, raising our own food, raising our own meat, trying to think about the impact of what we spend our money on, like supporting our local businesses and trying to, you know, just think about, children love to feel that they can do something about it. And one of the main problems of global warming is that it's so huge of an idea that a lot of times people just throw up their hands and go, well, what the heck can I do about that?
Molly, it sounds like you're homeschooling and you're acting with your kids in ways that you can right there in your local environment, which sounds great. When you go to bed at night and you think about the environment they're moving into, how do you think about it? How do you feel as a parent about the environment that we're leaving our children, your children?
Well, you know, when I was really young, I actually thought that I might not have children because I was so concerned about the environment as a teenager. I honestly thought, I'm not sure I want to bring someone into this world. And then I realized that there are so many beautiful places still in this world, including the place that I live right now. And I'm so excited about the place that I live that I want to take care of it. And I'm hoping that there's enough people that feel that way about the place that they live that they don't want to just throw up their hands and just give up. You know, they want to say, look how wonderful the world still is. Let's do everything we can to take care of it.
Molly, I appreciate your call very much. Jared Diamond, you're nodding along here. I mean, it's good to convey that to children, the beauty and value at the same time. Not everybody's living in a beautiful corner, and if some of these forecasts are right, many of us won't be before long.
Molly, I can really relate to what you're saying because you mentioned that you were doubtful about having children because of the state of the world. My wife and I also talked about whether to have children, and eventually we decided to do so, and some of our friends decided to do so, and some decided not to do so. So I can understand this issue. I can also understand, Molly, your central concern with your kids figuring out what can we do about it. So what should one say to children about what to do about it? One thing is eventually children are going to be able to vote. Tell your kids to make sure that they vote because most Americans don't vote. Even now, when your kids are not old enough to vote, there are things that they can do, such as pulling weeds, going on protest marches. My kids in kindergarten went on the first protest march. Zoe Foster earlier in the program talked about planting for the planet. And still another thing that young people can do is talk to their parents. Molly, you recognize the issue, but there are issues, but there are lots of adults who do not recognize the issues. And young people who learn about environmental issues in schools can start out by educating their parents. Children have the ears of their parents, and parents who poo-poo environmental issues are not going to brush off their children if the children threaten not to speak to them again.
Lots of challenges to societies, to civilizations unfold over generations. You've looked at many of these circumstances over time. When you look at our circumstances now, what's the level of responsibility or irresponsibility that you see in at least among adults who have the potential to change things? How are we doing as a generation in our responsibility to the one coming up right now that will spend most or all of its life in the 21st century? What's the level of responsibility or irresponsibility in what we're leaving them?
Interesting question, Tom, that I've thought about. There's a tendency to think that the time we're in now is the most difficult time in human history.
Yeah.
and there are good reasons to think that the present decade is really a grim decade for the United States, with trends getting worse and worse. On the other hand, I grew up during the Cold War. I experienced the Cuban Missile Crisis, so there were bad things happening in the past. Despite all those bad things happening in the past, I still think that now is the most difficult time that the United States has faced in my lifetime because of the accumulation of problems, the increasing rate with more and more people consuming more and more. Yes, there have been problems in the past, but the problems are getting faster and faster, and they're getting global. And for the first time in human history, there is a clock running out. We have to solve the problems within the next few decades, because if they're not solved in the next few decades, if they're not solved basically by the year 2040 or 2050, when my own kids will be 63 years old, they will be in a world not worth living in. That's new.
Bob in Norfolk, Virginia. Bob, you're on with Jared Diamond.
Hello. A simple question, but a complicated question at the same time. Is Homo sapiens maladapted? Are we as a species maladapted? And in terms of evolution, you know, we usually think of physiology or morphology as being selected for or against, but behavior is also selected for or against. And it seems like a pessimistic question, but are we so maladapted that we can't do anything about the effects that we're having on the climate?
Bob, I assume you mean by that in a way that the things that have been our strengths as a species at some point become a weakness or a vulnerability.
Yeah, Dr. Diamond said the big brain is our strength. The big brain is also our weakness. Is our big brain maladapted to the point where we're really not going to be able to solve these problems?
Chair Diamond?
Interesting way of putting it, Bob. Is our big brain maladaptive? To put odds on it, I would say the chances are 49% that our big brain will prove maladaptive and will mess up, and the chances are 51% that our big brain will enable us to solve our problems.
That's very uncomfortably close to a 50-50 toss-up here.
You're correct, Tom. It is close to a toss-up, but what it means is that we face big problems, and anyone poo-pooing the big problems has their head firmly embedded in the sand. But the big problems are ones of our making, and we know how to solve our problems. We know that reducing, for example, global climate change requires burning less fossil fuels. That's obvious and it's well understood. What's missing is the political will. There's been a shift and there's more political will now than there was a few years ago. But we don't need any magic bullets and we don't need new technology. We just need a lot more talking. We need a lot more on-point shows. And we need more people, particularly more young people, understanding the problems that the world is getting into and realizing that they have to be taken seriously, but that they're solvable and they're solvable with our brains.
China and the U.S., the biggest carbon CO2 emitters. What about these two societies and the way they're organized? Rather differently, but if these are the two big players, and there are others, but if these are the two big ones, compared to others who have succeeded or failed in the past in meeting dire challenges, do these look well organized to, as you say, acknowledge and respond to the challenge in front of us?
Interesting question, Tom, and that's one thing that, believe it or not, gives me hope. China and the U.S. produce between them about 41% of world CO2 emissions, which means that never mind difficulties with the UN and world government. If just China and the US could reach an agreement in their own interests, that would deal with 41% of CO2 emissions. But if China and the US were then joined by the European Union, Japan, and India, there are 61% of carbon dioxide emissions. That's something that makes me hopeful. Both China and the U.S. are recognizing, we're having it shoved in our face, that there are things going wrong in both countries. And if China and the U.S. then act on behalf of our own interests, and if we can convince India, Japan, and the European Union to act on behalf of their own interests, then even without world government, we've dealt with the majority of carbon dioxide.
Are there, over the stretch of history, are there political or power characteristics of societies that acknowledge and respond to challenge versus those who don't?
My belief is that the societies that respond best to challenges are modern democratic societies, more than dictatorships. Dictatorships, if they make a good decision, the good decision gets put into action fast. When China decided it was getting lead out of gasoline, lead was out of gasoline within 1 year in China. It took a decade in the United States. So dictatorships can make decisions fast, but nobody in world history has figured out how to devise a dictatorship so that it's more likely to make good decisions than bad decisions.
Is the United States then bearing out your thesis that modern democratic societies respond more effectively? We think of ourselves as the very prime example of that.
Up till now, I would say democracies in the 20th century have done better than the dictatorships. There were two famous dictatorships in the 20th century, Germany and Japan, which made some very bad decisions that killed millions of their own citizens. It wasn't the democracies that started the war. It remains to be seen, Tom, let's come back 10 years from now and we'll see whether the democracy of the United States is making good decisions about the problems facing us now. Our children will be very interested in the answer to that question.
Kelly in Kingston, Rhode Island. Kelly, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I have a just a point to put out there. I had heard earlier the statement about, you know, how climate change is a hoax to take tax dollars away. And my point is that even if it is a hoax, which I personally believe it's not, I believe in climate change. But if it is a hoax, then, you know, and if we do change the way that we find our energy and we become sustainable, then why is that such a bad thing? And that's for my point for the people who don't believe in climate change.
Kelly, may I ask how old you are?
I have just turned 25, or I'm going to be turning 25. I'm a recent graduate from the University of Rhode Island. I'm a animal science major, so part of my major is dealing with climate change.
And how do you feel about how your generation is likely to do with that in your lifetime? Do you think it will be successfully taken on? Is it a big source of fear to you or not?
Well, it's definitely a major concern, and I see it with a lot of my peers. And, I think that if we could get investors or investment from older people or like through education, because education is so expensive and so important. I just think that, my generation and younger people just need more advocacy and more, just be stronger instead of just, going through the day-to-day life of paying bills.
Kelly, I appreciate your call. Jared Diamond, speak to Kelly. She's 25. To Kelly and younger, let's say, people who really will live the majority or all of their lives in this century, what's the list of things you'd recommend to them? Here are the things, yes, they're the basics, vote, be involved, think. But in terms of steps to take, what looks most effective to you, author of Collapse, if they would like to avoid the collapse you warn might be out there?
Kelly, at age 25 and younger, you and I want to end up at the same place. My strategy would be different from yours. I'm talking about addressing the people who believe that climate change is a hoax. I would take a stronger position, Kelly. I would confront them with the overwhelming evidence now that climate change is not a hoax. That's a starting point. And then as for my list of recommendations for younger people, the list of recommendations, Kelly, for you, you at age 25 can vote now. Make sure that you vote. The number of Americans who vote in presidential elections is only 60%. The fraction of Los Angeles citizens, my city, who voted in the recent mayoral election is only 20%. Kelly, for heaven's sakes, vote. Persuade your friends to vote. There have been some recent elections decided by very few votes. It really makes a difference. So vote. Talk to other people. As you accumulate money, Kelly, give your money to causes that you believe in. Small amounts of money get multiplied, and then do things yourself, creating a better world around you. While it's difficult for you, Kelly, to transform the whole world, you can start out by transforming your neighborhood and setting an example for other people to transform their neighborhoods.
And with those votes, vote for what? For what policy?
To vote for sane environmental policies and sane economic, social, and political policies in the United States.
Can they do it, this generation? Can they turn it around in time to to stave off the worst and maybe even bring something better.
Yes, all is not lost. We still have a chance to save ourselves.
Jared Diamond is the third chimpanzee for young people out now. Jared Diamond, a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you very much for coming in.
Tom, it's great to be with you. It's a pleasure.
Jared Diamond. Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.